and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being with us. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and man, do we have a good day lined up for you today. A very blessed Holy Week to you. It's maybe the strangest of Holy Weeks. At least in the last 2,000 years, but it's going to be a very interesting time, and we're looking forward to spending a whole bunch of hours with you this week trying to answer questions about the Catholic faith. Really, in a lot of our priority this week is to just give praise to God, who has given everything for us on the cross, and this is the week that we remember that. And also, as we've been saying lately, to be good company. We're going to try to be good company for you. And this hour, we've got really good company for you. You all know Steve Ray, traveler, writer, filmmaker, leader of pilgrimages to the Holy Land and to many places around the world. Hello, Steve Ray.
Hello, Cy. Good to be here with you.
Well, it's good to be with you. Now, among all of us, your life must be among the most changed.
It's very changed.
Yeah.
It's very changed because we lost out on a March, April, and May pilgrimage to the Holy Land. May is still, but doesn't look good. And two trips to Oberammergau in June and August. So pretty much we're home. And I got a trip to the Holy Land the end of July, first week of August. We put that in there for the people who missed out in March, April, May. And anybody who wants to go, it's going to be a good price because this summer it's the low season. But yeah, we're pretty much home. I'm writing books. I'm doing Catholic Answers Live. I'm writing the script for our next documentary movie in the Footprints of God. It's going to be Doctors of the Church. So I'm busy, but not the way I want it to be.
Yes, right. I guess that's true for everybody. But you're used to living out of suitcases and traveling through airports and all that. So a strange time indeed. So I know we're all guessing at it, but you're thinking at summertime, maybe you'll travel again.
The indications I'm getting from my contacts in Israel is that they're going to, right after Passover, start getting back to normal, which means next week. And if that's the case, and they open up their borders by July 1st, even, I'll be back in Israel. I'll be the first one back. And I've got a group already. We've already getting people registered, almost a half a bus already for the end of July. So anybody wants to go summer, let us know. Hey, is it all right if I wear my hat and my bird shirt? Because, I'm a bird watcher. I love doing that on my free time. And because spring is coming and the birds are all here, I wore my bird sweatshirt today. My grandkids like this. And I'm wearing my hat. I feel right at home here with you guys today.
Yeah, well, you're kind of known for your hat, so you got all that. As a bird watcher, have you seen that whatever the rare bird is? What's your rare bird that you sought out and found?
Well, we've seen some really cool ones. We saw the snowbirds. They only come down in the coldest of years. We've only seen those once. And the rufous-sided towhee, we see him every 4 or 5 years. But we love these sandhill cranes in our backyard. They're huge. And they wake us up in the morning, tell us it's time to get up. And we love the red rose-breasted grosbeaks and the towhees. And there's just a whole bunch of them. And I keep track of when they come every year and when they leave. And we have fun with it. And the grandkids are all learning all the birds and how to tell their sounds when they're in the trees. And just a real quick thing. We heard my daughter was pregnant. She called us and said, "Dad, we think we're going to have the baby." This was 3 days ago. And we said, "Okay, we'll run over and pick up the little guy. He's 2 years old." So she said, "Okay." We drove 20 minutes home, and she sent a picture of her with a baby. And I said, "What's this?" And my wife said, "That's the kitchen floor." So my daughter went out to the car, said to her husband, "I'm not going to make it," ran back in the house and had the baby on the kitchen floor.
Wow.
And they're both doing and fine.
That's the thing. Okay, good. Yeah, I'm glad to hear it. Well, congratulations. Great. Another grandkid.
That's number
17.
Number 17.
Wonderful. Good. Congratulations on that. Well, I want to let folks know what we're going to do together today. Today, we're going to talk about the people at the foot of the cross. At the end of this week or throughout the course of this week, we'll be meditating on various parts of the Passion of the Lord. And as he gave his life for us on the cross, there were people at the foot of that cross. And you find meditating on each of those people to be a spiritually helpful thing to do.
Oh, yes. It was fascinating. And I just one day last year, I said, let's see how many actual different people or groups or entities were actually there. When Jesus looked down from the cross, what did he see? Who did he see?
Yeah.
And so I came up with a whole list and we'll go through them. I think there's about 15 different groups or people, and every one is fascinating. And we can learn from every single one of them.
Well, let's do that then. Let's take a look at the people who are at the foot of the cross. It's not like Jesus was surrounded by friends. They're not all friends of his at the foot of the cross.
This is really a mixed bag.
Yeah, which is what we are.
That's right.
Even today, we're a mixed bag, looking up at the Lord on the cross. But I suppose. The first person, if you said who was at the foot of Jesus' cross, almost every person who knows the Gospels even a little bit will say Mary.
Mary and John, because they have seen the crucifixes and the paintings, and it always has Mary on one side, John on the other, looking up at Jesus. And that we're told that in the Gospel of John, that they were there at the foot of the cross. They were the first ones splashed with the blood of Jesus after Simon the Cyrene. He was the first. But when the sword went in the side of Jesus, the lance, these two, Mary and John. And interestingly enough, Mary, she is now learning something she's been wondering about for 33 years. When Jesus was born, and at the 40th day, she wrapped that little baby up, so proud of him, took him to the temple to do the sacrifices and to present him there. And this old man named Simeon comes up, and he said, this baby will be a sign of contradiction in Israel, and many will stand or fall because of him, and a sword will pierce your soul also. What's a 15-year-old girl supposed to think of that? She's got this brand new little baby, takes him to the temple. She's going to present him, and this man comes up and said, a sword's going to pierce your soul also. Well, she doesn't know what that means. There's no indication that Mary would understand what that meant until now when she's at the foot of the cross. She realizes what that means. And at Calvary, when I take my groups to the Holy Sepulchre, and if you want to see the official closing of the church due to the virus, it's on my blog, catholicconvert.com. You can see the official closing. It's very sad, but you also get to see some of the inside. We'll mention it several times today in this discussion, the inside of the Holy Sepulchre and inside the tomb like you've never seen it before. And she's now being told, up there by where the cross is, there's this beautiful statue of Mary, and her face is so realistic, and there's a sword going right into her chest. It's very graphic.
Wow.
And here you've got Mary and John at the foot of the cross. The interesting thing about those both is Mary did not have any other sons. So in Jewish custom and tradition, if she had a second-born son, Jesus would have just said, second-born son, take care of mom. But Mary did not have any other sons, so Jesus had to put her into the hands of John, the young, beloved disciple, and said he says to him, basically, John, take care of my mom.
And so you say that they were the first splashed with the blood of the Lord. That's very graphic, but it doesn't, as with everything with Jesus, that might sound like the most negative thing in the world, but this is the saving power of the Lord really being poured out upon them. So they're representing us at this moment, John and Mary.
They are. They're representing us. And John, when Jesus gives Mary to him as his mother, the early church and the church fathers and all of us have always seen that John represents all disciples. Therefore, he gave Mary to all of us as well. He gave her to all of us to be our mother. And Mary, on the other hand, says to this young man, you're now my son, and you're going to take care of me but I'm also going to take care of you in ways you don't even know. Can you imagine living with Mary your whole life? How would you live differently if she moved in and lived at your house? Anyway, and so now she becomes our mother in that symbolic way too, that the conversation between Jesus and those two, we are the disciple, Mary becomes our mother, and we become her children. And that's also, we find in the Bible, that Mary's the mother of the church. The devil went out to do war against the rest of her offspring, which is us.
Right. 888-318-7884. Our number, Steve Ray, is our guest. We're talking about the people at the foot of the cross, the actual people who were standing there at the foot of the cross when the Lord was crucified today. 888-318-7884. You know, when you say that about Mary living in your house, one of the things that is notable about holy people, and she's as holy as you could possibly be, they actually make you in many ways a better person, and they don't make you feel guilty about who you are. It's just natural that they kind of bring you up. I think it would be just the greatest blessing to have her in your house.
Yeah, but you may not say everything you would say normally. You may not act the same.
No need to review those. You're that's right.
You may be more careful. And you know, she also lived with James, because James and John lived together. So James also had her in his home.
Oh.
So they lived together as extended families.
888-318-7884. The number right now, we've got that store-wide sale still going on. All books, CDs, DVDs, MP3s, ebooks, everything we've got, 10 to 25% off. In some cases, much more than 10 to 25% off. Just go to shop.catholic.com and find all the savings you might want on all kinds of Catholic books, DVDs, CDs, MP3s, and every other form of media. Shop.catholic.com.
This is Bishop Chad Zielinski from the Diocese of Fairbanks of Northern Alaska, and you are listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy. The latest episode of our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus, is available. This week we talk with Father Hugh Barber about how much theology you have to know to be a good Christian in the modern world. Is it still okay to have simple faith, or does every Christian need to take up the intellectual life? Here's a little sample.
Wisdom is a way of knowing that's the result of union with the one known. You know, it's not like study, like understanding or science is based upon examining something and learning all about it and having it in your head. The wisdom is more a question of the adhesion of our heart and mind to the one in whom we believe and whom we love. And that's a different, it's like maternal love or the love between a husband and his wife or children and their parents. It's an instinctive, intuitive union that makes us know things and have a sense of things simply because of our love for the other. That's what it ends up being.
You can hear the rest and get past episodes at CatholicAnswersFocus.com or subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
We talk to audiences all over the world. One thing I've found out is everybody in the whole world has the same set of questions. They live the same human life. They all want meaning. They all want love. They all want significance. They want forgiveness. That's the most fascinating thing to me. The same answers work wherever you are throughout the world because we're all children of God.
Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders tonight, 11 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Steve Ray, our guest this hour. We're talking about the people at the foot of the cross. Who was there at the foot of the cross? Steve found, I don't know, almost 20 people, somewhere in the high teens of people standing there at the foot of the cross. Steve, your last one is most interesting to me, but I want to take a minute before, and I'm going to get the callers. You can call 888-318-7884. I have to just tell you, I'm confused by the Marys at the foot of the cross, and maybe you could help me with that. All these women, who are all the women that are there with Mary, the mother of Jesus, at the foot of the cross of Jesus?
Well, the reason there's so many Marys is because that was one of the most popular names. Where did it come from? It's not Mary, it's Miriam, with a rolling R, which I can't do very good. Miriam, because that's the sister of Moses. She was a hero. She was like one of the saints that all of the New Testament people looked up to as a saint. There was others too, like Sarah and Hannah and Judith and so on. So this is a very popular name, and a lot of people had that name, just like Peter today. You get so many guys named Peter, or there's, you know, there's some certain names that are very similar. So it says here that you have Mary Magdalene. You have Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. That's a different Mary. And then you have the mother of the sons of Zebedee. Her name is Salome. So you have Mary, the wife of Clopas. And each one explains them a little bit different. And almost one of them at John, it says at the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister. And that's a different one that people aren't used to. Mary's sister was there. It was Jesus' mother and his mother's sister,
right.
Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. So you have, it was a very popular name, obviously.
I think I've got that straight. Is help me, Steve. Is Mary's sister is not named Mary, though? There's like a comma in there. Or is she named Mary?
Flip a coin. If you look at what scholars have said, some think that her name was also Mary, but then some think it's at the foot of the cross were his mother, comma, his mother's sister, comma, Mary, the wife of Clopas, comma, and Mary Magdalene. Others think it just says by standing at the cross, Jesus were his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. I think it's not another. I think it's his mother's sister, and then Mary of Clopas is another one. That's my opinion.
I got you.
Now that everyone's thoroughly confused, let's go to the last one. Now, what I sent you five pages. I sent you six pages that I have printed out of all of these people or entities. I have to say entities too, because I throw the temple in there. I throw God the Father and the Holy Spirit in there, and nature. Nature rebels. Nature is there. Mm-hmm. And when it sees its own creator, the creation was made through him and by him. And nature just, I think, rebels that day. And the sun is hidden and the rocks crack and there's an earthquake. So I say that nature's there too. But I think maybe my favorite one, and partly because of a painting by Rembrandt, you and I are at the foot of the cross. You and I are, when Jesus looks out at what's in the view around him, he sees all these different people. But because he's God, yes, he's a man dying there in his human nature, but he's also God, and he has the ability to think of every one of us simultaneously at the same time. And so we were there too. And he says, I'm doing this for you, Si, as he looks down at the cross from the cross. I'm doing this for you, Steve. But Rembrandt, people should get after the show, not now, but go on Google and look up Rembrandt, Raising of the Cross. I think it may be my all-time favorite painting in the world. It's got a picture, it's kind of dark. Jesus is on the cross at about a little more than a 45-degree angle. They're raising him up, and he's almost going to be vertical soon. And you notice as there's one soldier just pulling so hard, there's another guy, and the light seems to be on his face a lot, and he's wearing a funny hat because it's a painter's beret from Holland, a Dutch painter's beret, and it's a self-portrait of Rembrandt. And Rembrandt is the one with the soldier pulling the cross up with Jesus on it, and what is he saying? I'm the one who raised Jesus on the cross. Yeah. It wasn't the Jews and the Romans. It was me who raised the cross. That is so beautiful. And then if you look, there's the centurion right behind him, and he's handing you something. And if you look carefully, he's handing you either the sword or the lance, but he's not handing it to you. He's handing you the handle. He's holding the blade, and he's handing you the handle, and he's saying, here, you put him on the cross, you stab him.
Ugh. Yeah, you know, it reminds me of Mel Gibson. I heard that Gibson did that in his movie, The Passion of the Christ, that the hands of the person that nails Jesus to the cross are Gibson's own hands.
I've heard that too, and I believe it because he's an artist, and he would do something like that because he understands the symbolism of that. And he, right. Someday in glory, on judgment day, he's going to say, Lord, I realize I'm the one that put you, remember my hands are on that cross that pulled you up there. But you and I were at the foot of the cross, and I think of all of the ones we're going to discuss today, that's the most important one, that you and I there, because we're going to have to acknowledge what he did for us and how he took our sins away, and he's paying for them there at that moment.
Steve Ray is our guest. The people at the foot of the cross is our topic. Our first guest, our first caller, Abby from Houston, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Abby, thank you for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Steve.
Hi, I'm 13 and a cradle Catholic, but I always had this question. Why did God send his son to die and then send an earthquake when Jesus actually died? He was the one who sent him. Why did he get mad?
That's a great question, Abby. I like that. You're 13 years old. I have grandchildren your age, and I love them, and I love because they're so inquisitive and they have these great questions. Well, let me see if I can answer it. Just because God sent his son down to die doesn't mean he's happy about it. In a one way, I think he is, because this is the way that he can show us how much he really loved us. It's his great demonstration of his love. He's showing all of us, sinners and saints, the devil and all the evil spirits, all of the holy angels in heaven, and even nature and the whole universe. Look how much I love Abby. This is it. This is my crowning moment. I'm so happy that I get to show Abby how much I love her. But at the same time, he's not happy about the fact that sin is there and what sin is doing to his son. And so the earthquake came, but as I think a reaction to that. But I think, Abby, maybe the number one reason is with that earthquake when that came and the sun was blotted out. It said that the soldiers saw that. And they believed and said, this surely is the Son of God. The two thieves on the cross were both reviling and cursing at Jesus. But I think when that earthquake came, the good thief had a conversion. As a result of that earthquake and the sun being blotted out, many people converted because they saw this is a miracle. This isn't just your average robber or thief on the cross. This must have been somebody special if even God's going to make an earthquake come and the sun stop shining. And so I think he was happy that his son was there because it was showing his love. It was a good thing. It was a bad thing because sin had done such evil to the world that he was showing how bad that evil really was, that it even took the death of his son. And that's not, he wasn't happy about that. I'm sure he, even Jesus said, Father, Father, why have you forsaken me? He felt the alienation there, Jesus, the man did. But I think a lot of it had to do with, because of that earthquake and the sun, a lot of people converted that day. Does that help any?
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
You're welcome, Abby. Keep asking good questions, Abby, and stay faithful to the Lord and stay being a Catholic all your whole life.
Thank you.
Thank you, Abby. 888-318-7884, our number. Steve Ray is here. He has many times been to the very place where the cross once stood. He's taken, I don't know, maybe tens of thousands of people to the Holy Land. How many people? Have you ever thought about that? How many people you've taken?
I have not. I have no idea. I know that I've been there almost 200 times now, something like that. Wow. And we've taken, you know, every time we go, we don't take huge groups because it's too impersonal. You feel like a cow in a herd. So we take either one bus or two buses. And so, but you multiply that out by 15 years, seven trips a year, one, two buses, it adds up to a lot of people. Everywhere I go, I have groups of people that come up. I went with you on this date. I went with you on this date. Oh, what a life-changing thing. It's a real joy. What a joy.
All right, up next is Jordan in New Jersey. Jordan, your question for Steve Ray.
My question is, did the Jews bring in Jesus and did the Romans kill him?
I missed the first part. Did the Jews what? To Jesus?
Yes. Did the Jews kill him and did the Romans bring him in?
It was a combination because the Romans would have done nothing. They did not want any trouble. They wanted to just leave it alone. And Pilate wanted to let's whip him and let him go. We don't want to make trouble. Because, see, during Passover, there are some estimates that as many as 2 million people came into Jerusalem. You know, a fraction of that on a normal day. But because the Jews came from all over the world to come to Passover, some estimates are they'd have 2 million people. And so Pilate wanted to keep no trouble, you know, no riots, keep it down. But the Jews were the one that insisted that he be killed because they said he's teaching against Moses and against the law and against the temple. And if we let him keep doing this, the Romans are going to come and take our temple away and we're going to lose all of our privileges. So we got to get rid of this guy. It was a political move on their part against Jesus. They had to get rid of him or they're afraid the Romans were going to take their temple away and come storming into Israel and take over and be brutal. So the Jews wanted to get rid of Jesus, but they couldn't. They couldn't kill him. It was against the law for the Jews to do capital punishment and kill. So they had to take him to the Romans. And the Romans did have the authority to kill. And they finally convinced Pilate to kill him. So the Jews were saying, crucify him. We're going to put our pressure on you. And they pushed and pushed until finally Pilate, the Roman, said, okay, we'll do it. And the Romans actually took Jesus out. It was the Roman soldiers that made him carry the cross, and it was the Roman soldiers that crucified him. But the Jews were there contributing and shouting and making sure they actually went through with the execution. But actually,
You can hear
it was us that put him there.
Jordan, thank you very, very much for the question. We're talking about the people at the foot of the cross. Your calls are welcome. 888-318-7884.
Your number one source for Catholic apologetics and evangelization, Catholic Answers Live. Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Many Catholics ignore the Bible. They say they have the Church instead. But we should embrace sacred Scripture, not just as the revealed Word of God, but as a Catholic work, intimately connected with the Church from the earliest centuries. In The Bible is a Catholic Book, apologist Jimmy Akin shows how the Bible cannot exist apart from the Church, in its origins, in the truths it contains, in its careful preservation over the centuries. Scripture is inseparable from the Catholic faith. This is fitting, since both come from God for our salvation. If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. After all, Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 1-844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Having to stay inside all day has led some to play video games with their free time.
But how much is too much?
Let's discuss tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Steve Ray, and we're talking about the people at the foot of the cross. Steve has put together a magnificent collection of those who are at the foot of the cross. Jordan, who just called, asked an interesting question about the role of the Jews and the Romans in the execution of Jesus. And it provides an opportunity to say that, especially in St. John's Gospel, the phrase the Jews, it means the particular Jewish authorities. I mean, clearly, John himself is a Jew. He's not talking about Peter, and he's not talking about Mary, and he's not talking about Jesus, all of whom were Jews. So it's almost as if to say the Jewish authorities. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I agree, because I don't want anybody to get the idea that we think that the Jews killed Jesus. That's certainly not the case. It was the Jewish leaders who were protecting their privileges. They were protecting their political privileges. Jesus was a Jew. Mary was a Jew. All the apostles were Jews. The Jewish people did not crucify Jesus. The Jewish leadership at the time that was protecting their prerogatives and their political position, they are the ones who did it. And in effect, in a way, you could even say they lost their Jewishness when they did it, because of they were actually denying the books of the Old Testament, and they were complicit with the Romans. They were actually forming a partnership with the Romans in a lot of things that they did, the leadership, especially the Sadducees. So make that a clear point, right. Absolutely.
And Caiaphas himself says why they're doing it, because if we don't do this, the Romans are going to come in our land. That's what he says.
Yep.
So I make note of that in part because I think as Christians we have an obligation to do that. Especially given the last century of persecution of Jews, not by Christians, but.
And I'll say that I love the Jewish people. I love going to Israel. I love being with them. And I always hoped that maybe someday I'd find out I had Jewish blood in me. I just wanted to think that even a little bit of Abraham's blood going through me. And when we did our 23andMe genealogical test, I'm 99% European, but I have 0.6% Jewish. And I could not have been happier.
You did it, Steve. Congratulations.
I
among the groups then of that you have at the foot of the cross of Jesus, you have a group that you refer to as taunting Jews, which is clearly there. And then you have believing Jews and acquaintances. So why don't you talk about those two groups real quick?
Well, you have two groups. Some believe that Jesus was the Messiah, and some were in favor of him simply because he had healed grandma. He had, delivered Uncle Festus from the plague, and he'd healed Grandpa from leprosy. Because some of these people, they loved him and were faithful to him, believed in him simply because of the miracles that he had done, and maybe for them personally. Many of them believed, and they were beating their breasts that they were so dismayed about his death. But then you have others that are mocking him and taunting him, among them the two thieves. In Matthew 28, it says both thieves were reviling Jesus and cursing him and giving him a hard time, both of them. But only after a time did the good thief decide to have a conversion. I think that St. Jerome says that it was the sun going dark and the earthquake when the thief saw that. He had a conversion, and I think that when his mind, his heart opened, God gave him a revelation, because think of this thief on the cross. You're next to a guy who's been beaten bloody. He looks like a hamburger meat, raw hamburger. He's so bloody and beaten up, and he's dying, and his face is mashed, and you say to him, "Remember me when you enter your kingdom." What kind of kingdom? I mean, what crazy way to— I mean, this guy does not look like a man who's going to enter into a kingdom. He's going to enter into the ground and worms are going to eat him. And this thief, though, he saw something. I think God gave him, he just gave God just an inch. I like what Father Chris Alar says, that at the end of our lives, God always comes and meets us and gives us a chance. When he talks about his book, Suicide, Father Chris Alar with the Marians. And I think that's the case. And this man must have just given a crack, and God flushed into there with all this light and said to him, "Believe on this." And the guy says, "Man, I see who he is." It had to be a revelation from God, because nobody looks at a man dying on a cross and said, "This is a king going into his kingdom." And so you have the good thief who did it. And why is there a good thief on one side and a bad thief on the other? Well, they're both bad thieves. Oh, here's a good joke that we use when we're guiding people. How do we know that he was a good thief? Because he stole eternal life at the last minute. Anyway, that's a bad joke. But you have one on either side, and I think that God did it that way to show you all of humanity in a nutshell. All of us are either on one side of Christ or on the other. We're either believers who are asking him to take us into the kingdom, acknowledging our own guilt and his righteousness, or we're the bad thief who just reviles and curses and goes on his way. Everybody listening is one of those two. And I think that's why he puts them in the middle like that.
It's fascinating that you it doesn't matter what you've done, you get to choose at any moment which of those two you're going to be too. Like you,
absolutely.
They had all up to that. Their biographies are exactly the same up to that point.
That's exactly right.
Yep. Up next is Marta in Miami, Florida, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Marta, thank you for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Steve Ray.
Okay, so we were meditating about the tradition this past week. And something that caught my attention is, like, if you see Padre Pio's stigmata and also, like, all the pictures about Jesus is on the palm of the hand where the nail was. But also, like, if you start reading, it says that it was in the wrist. So I want to know what you think about it.
Very good question, Marta. Thank you for calling. I think it's – I think we get too legalistic or too – can't think of the word right off, but the hand, when it says it went into his hand, that's the whole thing at the end of your arm. And if you feel in where you're, if you put a nail right in the center of your hand, the palm, so to speak, and put a lot of weight on it, just feel with your fingers on pinching on either side, the nail would slide right between your fingers and out because there's no bones or gristle or sinew to hold that nail in. But if you move down to the bottom of your palm, still in the palm of your hand, but you can feel there's a bunch of different bones. And I just wrote an email to a guy 10 minutes before the show started because people ask me that a lot. But if you, in the palm of your hand, at the lower part of the palm, if you put your finger in there, there's a whole bunch of bones in there. And if you put the nail in that part, it's still in the palm of your hand. It's just the lower part of the palm. I'm not talking about the wrist where your wristwatch goes, but the lower part of your palm, if you follow your thumb right down, boom, right to that point, that's where I think the nails were, because if you pounded the nail in there and you put a lot of weight, it would still hold the nail. But the Romans were also smart because they knew there was a nerve there called the median nerve, which is one of the most painful nerves. I'm not a doctor. I've learned this by reading. But one of the most painful nerves in the whole body, and even during World War II, morphine did not cut the pain of that median nerve. So the Romans wanted it to be as painful, as gruesome, as degrading, as dehumanizing and painful as they could. So they knew right where to put that nail, right there at the base of the palm, not the wrist, but in the palm, right where your thumb points in a way. And not only would they stay on the cross with that, but it would also send the most excruciating pain through their whole bodies. And the way I do it, by the way, on my website too, I have two DVDs in my conversion story on sale, but one is called The Stations of the Cross, where I go through each one of them describing it. And then the second CD is The Pain of the Crucifixion, where I go into great detail about these kind of facts. But the Romans knew what it was, and I call it a symphony of pain. He was experiencing a symphony of pain, like every musical instrument, every corner of his body, the pain was just reeking up into his brain. And it was a horrible thing. But that's how I explain the nail in the hand. I hope that helps.
Does that help you, Maria?
Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome, Marta. Thank you.
Oh, that was Marta. All right, Marta, thank you. Let's go to Timothy in Kerrville, Texas, watching on Facebook Live. Timothy, your question for Steve Ray.
Hello, Steve. I'm a big fan. Just wanted to let you know that.
Well, thank you.
But my question was, Barnabas in his epistle, I have it, and I couldn't find where at in the chapter where he, Jesus on the cross, I guess with his arms wide and reminding him of Moses when he was on the hill to prevent one of the wars.
And the Amalekites.
I wanted to know, okay, was Barnabas an eyewitness to Jesus Christ on the cross? Do we hold that in our history? I don't know the answer, but yeah.
Well, let me answer first that that is a story in the Old Testament of they were fighting the Israelites were fighting the Amalekites, who represent the devil and sin in the world. And Moses, as long as he held his two arms up with his staff, the Israelites won. When his arms fell down because, oh, he's so tired, then the Amalekites were winning. So he had Aaron and Hur, H-U-R, hold his hands up. It's like the cross, a man on each side, just like Jesus had a man on each side. So that's very good of you to think about that, Timothy. But the idea of Barnabas, we don't know. It doesn't tell us. What we do know is that Barnabas was a believer on the day of Pentecost, which is only 50 days from now, because Pentecost means the 50th day. 50th day from what? From the Passover lamb being slain. Jesus is the Passover lamb, and Pentecost is the 50th day after that. And we know that Barnabas was already there. His other name was Joseph. And Barnabas means encourager, one who encourages. So it's more like a nickname. His real name was Joseph. Barnabas means that one who is encouraging. He's a helpful, friendly guy. Everybody liked him. And he was there, and he sold his property and gave it to the apostles. So my guess is that he was probably there at the cross. He probably was watching because he was already a believer and one who was probably there, but we don't know for sure.
Okay.
And I just wanted to know, is that Barnabas that baptized Paul?
We don't know. No, that was Ananias who baptized Paul. That was in Damascus many, many years later. But Barnabas was Paul's partner. And Barnabas and Paul worked together, but then they had a falling out. And it said they had a great contention between them, and they went their separate ways. But Barnabas did not baptize Paul. That was Ananias, who was up in Damascus at the time.
Thank you for the call. We're talking with Steve Ray about the people at the foot of the cross today. I don't want to finish this hour, Steve, without asking you about Adam's skull. So we'll do that when we come back. Adam's skull at the foot of the cross. If you have questions about the people at the foot of the cross, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. And we've still got free ebook for you, 20 Answers Prayer. Visit shop.catholic.com today and look for the banner at the top of the page to download your free copy of 20 Answers Prayer.
Catholic Answers Live with
Steve Ray.
Today on Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul's Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Looking for a 2020 view on how Catholics are voting in the upcoming election? EWTN News and Real Clear Opinion Research are partnering to bring you clear and concise data on where the nation stands on issues, candidates, policies, and more by surveying Americans, including Catholics like you. And it's available now at EWTNnews.com/poll.
Covered some of the folks who are at the foot of the cross of Jesus. That's our topic this hour with Steve Ray. Next hour, we've got a chaplain in for you. We've got a priest in for you. So if you have a question for a priest, it's Ask a Priest Hour next hour with Father David McConey. And he's a wonder. You're going to really like talking with Father David McConey. So if you got a priest question, something about your prayer life, your family life, something that would be appropriate for a priest to answer, and it doesn't have to be a pastoral thing. If it's a theological question that you'd like help with from a priest, something in the moral life, next hour is for you. This hour, we're talking about all those folks at the foot of the cross, and we've hit quite a few of them. But tell me about this tradition of painting Christ on the cross. And there's a skull on the ground in front of him, Steve.
Yeah, people don't notice that. But if you look at icons, especially of the crucifixion, you'll notice in many of them, there is a skull at the base of the cross, and that is Adam's skull. And at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, there is a disc in the floor, by the way, that says in Armenian, this is where the holy women stood to look at, watch Jesus from that point. But there's also a chapel under Calvary which is like a huge rock, and you go down to the base of that, and that chapel has always been called the Chapel of Adam. And there's an icon there with Jesus on the cross and the skull of Adam below. Why? Because there's a pious tradition. I don't think that there's credibility to it, I mean in reality, but it is a pious tradition, almost like a typology or a prefiguring, that Adam was buried there, and that when he, the first Adam, was at a tree of life and brought about death to all of mankind in a garden, we know that Jesus in 1 Corinthians 15 is called the new Adam or the second Adam, and he is also in a garden. John tells us that the cross was in a garden. Twice he tells us that. He wants us to know that so that we parallel what's happening with him on the cross with another garden, with the prototypical Garden of Eden. These two are parallels to each other. The first Adam at a tree of life brought about death, and he came, he was naked in his innocence in the garden and was kicked out of the garden clothed. The new Adam now enters a new garden. He comes in clothed, but he's stripped naked to restore the innocence of the first Adam. And at the tree of death, he brings about life. And the blood of the second Adam falls down onto the skull of the first Adam and redeems him. That's why that skull is there. And one of my favorite paintings is in a church called the Choral Church in Istanbul. I take my groups there when we go, and I love to see this. And in that chapel, there's a painting of Jesus pulling Adam and Eve out of their tombs on resurrection morning. He's got them both, and he's pulling them up. And Eve has her right hand covered with a red cloth because she's embarrassed that that was the hand that reached out to pick the fruit. But if you want to know their feast day, it's Saint Adam and Saint Eve, and their feast day is Christmas Eve.
That's why it's so much fun to have Steve Ray on. 888-318-7884, the number. John in Denver, Colorado, you're next. John's listening on 1060 AM. Your question, John, for Steve Ray.
Well, Steve, when Jesus when Jesus was scourged at the pillar, we have two ways of thinking about that. The Shroud of Turin says the ends of the whip were lead balls. Mel Gibson's movie says it was like a little piece of iron that tore into his flesh. I'm saying they can't both be true. And I'm with the Shroud of Turin. What do you say?
Well, I would have to say the Shroud of Turin, too. They were both wicked, and they both would rip the flesh because they were small enough. If you beat someone with rods, it's like hitting them with a garden hose. It bruises, and it breaks up the muscles and everything inside, but it doesn't make you bloody. Whereas a flagellum, the kind they had, would rip the skin and leave you a bloody mess. And there was no OSHA requirements, no manufacturing requirements for how these whips are made. What would happen is the Roman soldiers would sit around the campfire at night and they would make these whips and they would say, mine's going to be more cruel than yours. Oh, no, yours isn't. Wait till you watch this thing rip the flesh off of the next guy we get. And they would make their flagellums to be as gruesome as they could. But I agree with you on the fact that the whips, the Shroud of Turin, I've seen it twice, the real one, when I took groups there when they came out the last two times. And that does show that there were like little barbells tied into that those whips. That would be devastating. And that's what it shows on the skin of Jesus on the shroud. And if I had to be a betting man, I would say that's the way those whips were made. I agree with you, John.
Right. Thank you, Steve. God bless you, buddy. Thanks for being around.
But one thing, too, is we remember when Jesus was whipped like that, those, you know, if they were whipping your buttocks, for example, and they would, because you were scarred from the top, from your neck all the way down to your ankles. They didn't just spank you on the butt like a parent does. They were whipping his back and his buttocks and the back of his legs. And those pieces of metal or whatever was in those would wrap around the leg and it would embed itself. When they jerked that whip back, everybody standing around would be splattered with blood and pieces of flesh. These guys were brutal, and these whips were brutal. They made the worst possible whips they could because that was the whole purpose, to make this the most painful thing, to be the example to everybody. What the Romans wanted to say is, if you defy the laws of Rome, if you defy us, even if you look at us wrong, this is what's going to happen to you. That's why they hung them in the city gates outside the city of Jerusalem. Every day there were people out there like that. This is what you saw when you took your grandkids to go see grandma and grandpa. You'd see these people hanging, and then your kids would grow up. I'm never gonna disobey Rome. But just think of the audacity of Jesus. It took a lot of chutzpah for him to say to his disciples, unless you are willing to carry your own cross like this, unless you pick up your own cross and carry it and get dying, you're not worthy to be my disciple. Just think, if I was going to start a club, and I said, everybody on the air today, I'm going to start a club, and but in order to be this, you have to be willing to carry a cross, be whipped and scourged and die hanging on a cross, which they kept people alive on the cross for up to 10 days. Jesus, only 3 hours. Can you imagine 10 days on a cross? And you are not going to be even worthy to be my disciple unless you're willing to go through that. That's what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. And maybe why
John,
he has so
you.
Few true ones.
Yep, Steve.
Yeah, indeed. Right. Thanks, John. I'm with both of you. I'm going with the Shroud of Turin. I mean, come on. Joan in Virginia, listening on Channel 130, EWTN on Sirius XM satellite radio. Joan, your question for Steve Ray.
Yes, thank you. I was just wondering about the custom, whether it was customary for family members, loved ones, to be able to stand at the foot of the cross. Or of any crucifixion, or was that a special privilege given to the Blessed Mother and those with her?
I don't think there was any special privileges given. The Romans didn't care about Mary. They didn't care about the disciples. They were there to get a job done, and they were going to get it done before the first star shone in the sky, because that was evening, and they had to have them all dead and killed and off the crosses and buried before Passover started with the first star. So there was no, I don't think there was any customs of that. The whole purpose of taking someone out and crucifying them like that was to make a show. These, and normally there would be no one there, because if you were a robber or you were a criminal and they took you out and they crucified you, the last thing you'd want to do, whether you were a parent or anybody else, is be anywhere near that man, because then you would be implicated with him. They would say, look, there's his mom and dad. They're the ones they taught. There's this. And all of a sudden you would then be questioned. So my guess is that most crucifixions, there was nobody there from the family. Nobody was around. And in this case, it was different because of who this man was. And like I said, there were some that were reviling Jews, and there were some believing Jews that were there. And the holy women, it says, came, and they followed Jesus on the stations of the cross. And Mary was among those holy women, and John came. The other men all ran away. By the way, this is a great moment for women, because men all got cowardly and turned around and ran. And I know that I've been married to a woman for 43 years, and I've learned something about these creatures called women. They are very noble. And when men fail in their responsibilities and they run, women will always step in and fill the gap. And these women came no matter what happened, because they loved Jesus. They knew who he was. Mary came because she obviously knew who he was, and she was there in a way to offer him. But I think under normal circumstances, nobody, friend or family, would be anywhere near that guy being crucified, because they didn't want to get involved in being implicated with him.
What do you think, Joan?
That's exactly what I was thinking. So I appreciate having it confirmed. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Joan.
I love watching Blue Bloods. It's a good Catholic cop show in New York. Very Catholic. And you'd see all the time, when there's a crime scene, they put up the yellow tape, get back. And if you come in, they'll push you back. And I think it was the same with the Romans. When they were crucifying Jesus, they were telling everybody to get back. We got our job to do. We're in a hurry. And they're nailing him and pushing people out of the way. But after that was over, they were over on the side. They were casting lots for his garments and his clothes. And then Mary and John could come up closer.
So you think that, like, maybe, like, I'm thinking if Peter and Andrew and all these other fishermen try to come up, this is a tough looking crowd, and the Romans wouldn't put up with it. But if it was women and a young man like John, yep, they would probably, yep, put up with it.
I see John as like a 15-year-old young whippersnapper.
Yeah.
He lived an old man too. He didn't die till around 100 AD or later. And so he was a young man, and he would be less of a threat. The men had already ran. We don't have any indication that they were there at the crucifixion to see that. They may have been at a distance, but we don't have anywhere where it says in John and Andrew and Peter were all, Peter and Andrew and the others were standing at a distance. We don't know that. It says they were witnesses to the resurrection. It never says they were witnesses to the crucifixion. And so the women, those guys would be there. They would say, those are his. Grab them too.
Right. Exactly. Yes.
Not want to be anywhere near. And so they weren't real disciples because they weren't willing to carry the cross with them.
Steve, where can people find you if they want to find out more, get more of your writing, maybe travel with you? Where can they go?
CatholicConvert.com. And I have some of these CDs up there right now if you want to get them at a good price. And happy Easter, everyone. And even though it's strange, God bless you all. This crazy Easter.
Indeed. Steve, it's always great. Thank you so much. Appreciate you doing it. Go to CatholicConvert.com if you want to know more about what Steve is up to. And before long, he'll be the first guy back on the airplane. You can count on that if you can go back to the Holy Land. Up next, Father David McConey with us. Ask a priest. If you've got a question for a priest, 888-318-7884.